The British colonies in the New World, and later the United States, were built on land taken from Native populations. Today's guest explores the interplay of Native Americans in the development of America's national identity. He's Philip DeLoria this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers around. Authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world around us. This week, we're joined by Philip J. DeLoria, who is the first ever tenured professor of Native American history at Harvard University and the author of Becoming Mary Sully, Toward an American Indian Abstract. Phil, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk a little bit about your scholarship, but we want to talk a little bit first about your background. You sort of have this interesting route to the academy, a musician turned journalist turned scholar. Talk to us about that evolution.
You know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to tell students this because so often they're just focused on what am I going to do, and my path has been very complicated. I found myself in high school as I was a trombone player, I was a musician, and I was pretty good, and I went to college as a music performance major. Realized a couple of years in that I actually wasn't that good, switched to music education, taught middle school band and orchestra for 2 years, but kept playing music and played bass and guitar, and I played in country bands and rock bands, and at one point our band sort of said, yeah, we'll all quit our jobs and we'll really go for it, and of course everybody else was working at Subway, but I quit my music teaching job at the Cherry Creek Public Schools.
Benefits,
exactly. And then I started working on music videos as a crew person, and kind of got involved in the world a bit of broadcast, and did a master's degree in broadcast journalism, mostly to sort of learn how to use the equipment.
Oh, really?
Then I was a night editor, videotape editor, back in the day when people shot to 3/4 inch and edited to 1 inch, kind of reel-to-reel tape before digital, really.
Well, and then you wind up at Yale in a PhD program. How does that happen?
So, for my master's degree, I did a professional project, and that project was a documentary about Sioux Indian land claims in the Black Hills, which was something that was unfolding in the late 80s and early 90s. And I got really interested in thinking about ethnographic filmmaking and filmmaking with indigenous and aboriginal peoples. I applied to Australia for a Fulbright. And then I applied to Yale and Indiana as sort of like my backup plan. I really did not know what I was doing at all.
We don't know what we're doing.
I did manage to get into those places, and I ended up going to Yale and American Studies. But it was nothing I had sort of thought about or planned. In a lot of ways, it was accidental.
Well, so we were chatting about this before we started taping. There's a wonderful profile of you in Harvard Magazine that describes the moment where you sort of had the epiphany of what your dissertation would be. Share that with us, because as a long-suffering graduate student, I marvel at that story.
Well, so interesting. You know, I had gone to my committee and said, oh, here's my idea. I want to talk about identity in a nested kind of way, because I was a Westerner in the East and I was really experiencing a bit of, they're like, that's not a very good idea. So I was quite depressed. And then I was sitting in class. Bill Cronin was the lecturer, one of the co-directors of my dissertation. And he was talking about this group called the Woodcraft Indians from the early 20th century, where this guy, Ernest Thompson Seton, in order to combat teen vandalism in his neighborhood, grabbed a whole bunch of boys, got them dressed up like Indians, and sort of took them out onto his estate and ran them around, and they had a big campfire and they cooked steaks, and the boys were like, yeah, this is really great. This is super fun. So Bill Cronin was talking about that, and the person sitting next to me, Gunther Peck, fine labor historian, turned and said, have you ever heard of this group called the Improved Order of Red Men? And I had heard of this group because growing up, Colorado was a skier. I passed through the town of Empire, Colorado. Every day I went skiing at Winter Park. And in Empire, there was an Improved Order of Redmen Lodge. And it was this fraternal order. And so at one point, I'd figured out what this thing was. And so I turned to Gunther Peck and I said, yes, I do know what this is. And suddenly, it just hit me. From the Boston Tea Party, through these fraternal societies in the 19th century, through Boy Scouts and Campfire Girls and the Woodcraft Indians in the 20th century, to the powwow circuit in the later 20th century, to New Age hippies in Boulder, Colorado, which was where, you know, I was coming from, that there had been this pervasive practice, not just of imagining Indians and sort of using them in cultural sort of ways, but imagining Indians and then dressing up and performing those kind of imagined identities. And so it just exploded in my head, this idea. Literally in 30 seconds, most of the dissertation laid itself out in analytical terms, which, you know, just doesn't happen that often. And so, yeah, I've never had anything else like it.
That's
it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
So it led to your first book, Playing Indian. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a book in the classic mold of an American studies book. And by that I mean books that sort of seek to ask, what is it about America? How do we understand the United States? How do we make sense of this place and the people? And my contribution to this was arguing that Native people, Indian people, American Indian people, have had this incredibly important place in American culture and in the American cultural imaginary and in the ways Americans imagine themselves and perform themselves. Part of this dressing up as Indians was dressing up and performing as Americans. And the Boston Tea Party, for example, is a really iconic moment, you know, here. It's pretty clear that these Indian disguises at the Boston Tea Party didn't really disguise anything. Everybody knew who everybody was. So why claim to be Indian at that particular moment? And so part of the argument was, you know, this is how colonists stop being British colonists and start being American sort of proto-citizens, right? How do you stop being British and be something else in order to wage a revolution? And so part of the argument was, you do it by grabbing on to the people who actually are indigenous to the time and the place, and dressing up and performing and acting out these things. And it happens throughout the revolution. There's all kinds of different ways in which colonists perform themselves and their identities as Indians. So this is sort of the argument that part of being American is engaging the sort of place of indigenous people in relation to the continent, that you can't actually be American without sort of taking that seriously, and that dressing up like an Indian is a way of working through some of the ideological contradictions to say, like, I'm of this place, but to be of this place, you have to say, yeah, but I did kill off and dispossess the actual people of this place. So there's a fundamental contradiction that happens here.
That certainly is a contradiction. Your background, your family, Native culture and history was very much part of your upbringing. Tell us a little bit about that and your own descent. And
yeah. So, you know, my dad, who died in 2005, Vine Deloria Jr., who was really one of the foremost Native American intellectuals and activists of the late 60s, 70s, and into the 80s and 90s. 50 years ago, he wrote a book called Custer Died for Your Sins, which was kind of the first kind of public, best-selling, stake in the ground, you know, for Native people. So this is the house that I grew up in, you know, full of conversations about indigenous peoples, about Native sovereignty. He came by this through his own sort of family history. His father, Vine Deloria Sr., was an Episcopal minister. His father, my great-grandfather, Philip J. Deloria, was also an Episcopal minister, one of the very first Native people, Lakota people, to be ordained in the Episcopal Church. And his father, Sasswe, or François Deloria, my great-great-grandfather, was a Yankton Dakota medicine man and sort of leader of what they called the half-breed band. So he was mixed. This was a mixed family, full of mixed people marrying mixed people. And so the family goes a long way back. I've just laid out the male side, but there are really important women in this family as well. So my great aunt Ella Deloria, who worked with Franz Boas at Columbia University, was a Native linguist and actually recorded a lot of did a grammar, a dictionary of the Lakota Dakota language, recorded a lot of stories. And then her sister, Susie Deloria, or Mary Sully, who's the subject of the book that's just coming out. So it's a big family with a lot of stories.
How has your
family's heritage and your awareness of that heritage, you think, shaped your scholarship on these issues?
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting, right? I mean, I think everybody's entitled to their Oedipal moment. And for me, you know, part of doing a lot of music was sort of not doing what my dad was doing and what I could see a long succession of Deloria's kind of back, and laterally as well, my aunt and uncle, you know, as well. So, you know, so I was a little bit resistant to, you know, to sort of thinking about those sorts of things. And then I found myself coming back around, you know, sort of fully, you know, fully into it. And now, of course, you know, it really is, I have been thinking about my dad a lot over the last year or so. I think the 50th anniversary of this book has been kind of a big deal for me, and a bit of a, as well as coming to Harvard, has pushed me into a bit more of a kind of deep emotional kind of re-engagement, you know, with it.
Interesting.
So tell us about your new book, Becoming Mary Sully.
Yeah.
Just out, and looks great.
Just out, yeah, I'm super excited about it. It's, you know, if I could go back to these two sisters, so Ella Deloria and Susie Deloria, really interesting women. So they were cosmopolitan, they were well-educated, they traveled around a lot. Ella, as I said, worked for Boas at Columbia, and Franz Boas was just really the founder of one of the major schools of American anthropology, trained a whole generation of women, of which in the late 20s and 30s and 40s, of which Ella was one. You know, so Ella has gotten a lot of attention. She's written really interesting, beautiful books, a beautiful book called Water Lily, kind of fictionalized sort of treatment of her ethnographic work told from the perspective of a Lakota woman. She always dragged around her sister, who was struggled with psychological and mental health issues, who was so shy she wouldn't come down and speak to people. The two sisters never married. They were a unit. They traveled together. And so she's really kind of come this close to being lost to, you know, to history. But she crafted, during the late 20s to the mid-40s, 134 of what she called personality prints. And they're not actually prints. They're colored pencil on paper drawings. Each one is a triptych, so each one has three parts. And each one is named after and meant to represent the personality of a famous person from the period. Most of the personalities, interestingly, are popular culture, people from the film world or radio or sports. A lot of them have been completely lost to us, you know, today. But what's interesting when you pull out these images and look at them, the top panel, there's three panels, the top panel is really quite abstract oftentimes. There might be symbols and signs and things that are visible perhaps, but it's hard to make sense of most of them. The second panel is really a design pattern, so it might show up as a wallpaper or a tile pattern perhaps. Textile pattern. And the third panel is a little bit smaller than the others, and it is really kind of a native sort of pattern or design, but not really quite. They're complicated sorts of things. And so these things came into our family in the mid-1970s after both the sisters had died. And my mom sort of took care of them over the years. And then we pulled them out in the sort of 2006-2007 period. And what you couldn't see in the 70s, like, who's Alice Fazende? I don't know. Do you know? I don't know. You could, by just pulling out your laptop and Googling people, you could actually start to discover who they were. And it turns out Alice Fazende, as an example, was the last living Confederate widow who died in 1939 or 8 or 9, as I recall, and got, you know, kind of a tiny little column inch in the Saturday Evening Post in 1934 when she turned, I think, 90, and then, you know, another little notice when she died. So she's a very obscure person, a kind of pop culture curiosity. But for whatever reason, Susie felt that she was interesting and important, and she wanted to do a piece of art about her. So there's 134 of these, and I've tried to make sense of them.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're delighted to join you four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular POTUS channel. That's the Politics of the United States, channel 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable and talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JMLutis. Joining me as always is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's also the author of 17 books, and you can connect with Wayne on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Philip J. DeLoria, the first ever tenured professor of Native American history at Harvard University and the author of Becoming Mary Sully, Toward an American Indian Abstract.
So there are a couple of questions that leap off at me, but first is, you know, did your aunt have artistic training?
Almost none. Yeah, almost none. She really struggled. You know, they went to the reservation school, then they went to the All Saints Episcopal School for Girls, which was a good school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Ella went on to Columbia and then to went to Oberlin and then to Columbia. Susie basically kind of muddled her way through one semester at the University of Kansas, where she did take a course in art history, contemporary America, and design. Those are her three courses. That's the extent of her training as far as I can tell. I think she did some correspondence courses later. There's some things, later in her life, she wanted to try to paint with oils. There's a correspondence course book among mm-hmm. some of her things. Mostly she's just self-taught.
So what is the significance of this collection? You know, if I'm not mistaken, it wasn't like there was a big exhibit of her stuff when she was living. So what's the significance? What's the impact? What's the meaning that you find in her work?
Yeah, no one really ever saw this. She had two shows, as far as I can tell, three maybe, both at Indian schools, where she sort of tried to mount the work. If you go back and think about the ways that American Indian people have engaged the American arts tradition, going to this very moment is when you find the first kind of evidences of this. In Oklahoma, in New Mexico, in Oklahoma, there's a series of folks, the Kiowa Six, who get a bit of training in their boarding school, who go to the University of Oklahoma, and a guy named Oscar Jacobson sort of takes them under wing. They show up at the Venice Biennale, they have some of their things published, and this is the very familiar kind of art that comes out of that moment. It's flat perspective, two-dimensional, kind of plain background, traditional subject. You would recognize this, this kind of work. It doesn't really engage modernism, abstraction, regionalism, social realism, those kinds of things, you know, at all. There's another school in Santa Fe that ends up doing something similar. So the significance of this art, I think, is that here's a Native artist who's completely engaged with modernism, and particularly the modernism that comes out of the aughts and the teens and the 20s. So it's an older kind of modernism. It's at the moment when European modernism and American modernism are really kind of informational sort of moments. So here's an American Indian artist who's not coming out of those kind of what we could call primitivist traditions, mm-hmm. not primitive, but primitivist. Modernists love when Indians represent, you know, primitive kinds of things. No, this is very different kinds of art. This is art that, I don't know if you've seen the Hilma af Klint exhibition that's just closed at the Guggenheim, but, you know, to me, there's these exploding resonances between these two women who are working in traditions that have been previously unrecognized. So the discourse around this particular exhibit has been, you know, we always think about Kandinsky and these other folks when we think about modernism. Here's Hilma af Klint actually doing it before mm-hmm. with an archive that has remained completely hidden. Well, for me, the parallels are quite similar. Here's an American Indian woman who's working in these kind of modernist forms with an archive that's remained hidden.
So let's come back to the present day and some of the issues confronting Native communities across the country, and we could do many shows on that. One that is making headlines, or certainly is in the news a lot, is the large numbers of indigenous Native women who are either missing or have become mm-hmm. victims of violence. What's going on there?
You know, I mean, there's a couple of ways to think about it. One way to think about it is, well, there's a sort of kind of epidemic over the last 30 years of these kinds of incidents where Native women in highly disproportionate numbers are the subjects of violence, of sexual abuse, and of just disappearance. You know, so the sort of seizure and the disappearing of Native women, the killing, you know, a lot of these Native women just disappear off the map. They meet violent ends. You know, and some part of this, you know, can be directly traced towards resource extraction in, you know, the Deep North, what Winona LaDuke calls the Deep North, North Dakota, South Dakota, the Southern Canadian provinces, where you have these man camps of folks and you have a large concentration of indigenous women. But I think a second way to look at it is this is actually a structural kind of violence that goes all the way back to the very beginnings. So the, you know, the earliest forms of enslavement tend to focus on Native peoples tend to focus on Native women and children. Colonial violence is oftentimes directed at Native women and children. So many of these massacres, you know, that you see and you hear about when you talk about the Indian Wars, these are directed at Native women. In the 1970s, sterilization programs directed at Native women. And
sterilization programs?
Absolutely.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S. If you're a Native woman, you could walk into an Indian health clinic, wanting to think about your reproductive rights or about childbirth, and you could walk out being unable to reproduce. And this has everything to do, I think, with the erasure of Native people, not just in American culture, but demographically, the demographic erasure of Native people. And if you're thinking about demography, women is one of the first places that you think about. And so I think there is a bigger and deeper kind of meaning embedded in this. There's a continuity of the violence directed against Native women that goes for hundreds of years.
So why Native women and not Native men to the same extent, historically and also today?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to downplay the violence against Native men either. But I think, you know, In one way, this is the most vulnerable population. They are the easiest to attack. In another way, I think the reproductive sort of rights of a population, you go after women if you're trying to sort of reduce the population. This happens, for example, in California in the missions. Who can reproduce, who can't reproduce, right? The missions actually try to take control over that. So any time that we have moments where, you know, we really sort of edge into what we can, I think truly in many cases, call genocidal kinds of violence against indigenous peoples, women are one of the central targets. Because in some ways, it's just a much more effective way of destroying a population. Not only do you kill individual people, but you kill their right to reproduce and you kill their future.
Now, I said earlier that the current situation has drawn headlines, and that's true, it has drawn headlines, but not exactly, you know, 24/7 headlines. This is a story that on some levels really is not reaching the mainstream. Why is that, do you think?
You know, this is a sad thing for me. And, you know, in some ways, I think it's Native people, you know, make up 1.5 to 1.7% of the population, you know, depending on how you count in the census and all of that. And I think Native people get about 1.5% of our collective attention and in ways that it's just wrong. It's just wrong. Native people have so many more kinds of points of articulation with national conversations and discussions. I would say the 1.5% is episodic at best, right? Indigenous people move into the consciousness at one particular moment and they quickly sort of fall out. The efforts that many Native people have made to sort of stay within the sort of realm of attention, you know, are really notable. There's a fantastic generation of young Native journalists out there right now doing incredible kinds of...
And they're very active on social media,
too. They're very active on social media.
I follow a number of them, yeah.
Yeah, they really know what they're doing.
Yeah, they do.
They're very, very smart. So this is the next generation, and they are, you know, true intellectuals and really quite impressive. Folks like Julian Noisecat, Rebecca Nagel, you know, other folks like that. But they are struggling, right, within a really complicated media environment to hold people's attention. And I just think it's hard, and it's always been hard for Native people to put their claim, right, in on, no, this is an important kind of project that we need to talk about.
You know, so there are a number of other sort of sensitive issues in the public consciousness around Native American identity and appropriation by, well, let's talk about, you know, sports teams. The Washington National Football League team in particular leaps to mind. Despite these sort of, you know, I think that as a society we've become more sensitive about racism and discrimination in general, but there are NFL owners who just will dig their heels in and say, we're never going to change that name.
Well, the owner of the Redskins, for example.
Dan Snyder, let's just say who he is.
Yeah. So, exactly. He said never. I mean, he put it all caps.
Yeah,
never
absolutely.
Will I.
Why is this not an issue that gets more traction?
You know, it is, on the one hand, it makes complete and total sense, right? I mean, if you erase Native people, if you sort of disappear them from the consciousness and from the place, and then you claim everything about them that you love, that is then it's not even a question for folks who have done that to sort of think like mascots. Well, that's not an issue.
It's an homage, right? It's
exactly. Yeah. No, we're doing this to honor them.
Yeah.
Right? We're doing this to honor ourselves, right, for what we did in terms of taking over this continent and making ourselves into a new place. And this is not to be anti-American, right? This is a very, very interesting and productive place, the United States. I mean, it's done incredible kinds of things. That rests upon fundamental, original sins of slavery and the dispossession of Native people from the continent. But I think, you know, the difference between African American and Native American kinds of issues are really sort of instructive here, right? That African American activists have long pushed for, because they have already been integrated in the form of slavery, right? Have pushed for integration and therefore civil rights. Native people, who are always separate and are separate within the bounds of the Constitution, have always said, yeah, we don't really want integration. We don't really care that much about your civil rights. We want to live our own way. We want to live our own lives. That's really fundamentally kind of contradictory there. And that is, in some ways, poses a maybe even more pointed kind of challenge to the ways that the United States thinks about itself. It would much rather push these things onto the back burner, deny that they are real questions or issues. And because of the demography, they're able to do that. Mm. And so you get, you know, the football team from Washington, you know, sort of making these sort of claims. Yeah, no, we're just honoring you. No, you're not honoring us. Yeah, we are. And then there's no need to sort of, but imagine Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, right, under fire, perhaps, you know, should resign because why he shows up in blackface.
Right.
But you can, how many politicians from that area can you imagine have been to Washington football games and put on face paint? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't done copious research, but, you know.
Well, certainly
many
a lot of fans do it.
The fans do it, right? Mm-hmm. And people support them, you know, in this. So, I mean, but let's just do the counterfactual. Would Ralph Northam would there be any call for him to resign if a picture emerged of him at a Washington football game with his face painted red?
No, the answer is no.
The answer is clearly no.
Yeah.
Why? Why is that even acceptable? Why is that a possible kind of thing for us to say?
Well, it's something that people need to dig into their souls and examine what's there.
You know, I mean, it has been interesting, you know, the ways that the last round, this comes up and it sort of like, you know, bubbles for a while, then it sort of subsides and it bubbles for a while. And the last round of this was, I have to say, interesting in terms of the African-American community of Washington, because they really jumped on board and started asking self-reflective questions about
that. Phil DeLoria, we need to leave that there. Thank you so much for being with us. The book is Becoming Mary Sully. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.